This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is a trend in higher education toward a dependence on adjunct faculty. These are non-tenured, part-time professors. 40 years ago, they made up 20% of a college or university's faculty, on average. Today, they make up more than 50% of faculties nationwide. These positions often come with low salaries, in some cases less than the federal minimum wage. In fact, it is estimated that 25 to 30% of adjunct faculty receive public assistance. The result is that now adjunct faculty members at some colleges and universities are rising up, complaining that they are being taken advantage of and their treatment is diminishing the profession. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn has been reporting on this in a special series this week and joins us to fill us in. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us is Dr. Joan Lorton, Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
And Dr. John Cox is here, too. He's an Associate Professor of International Studies and History at UNC Charlotte, a tenured professor who has worked as an adjunct. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Okay, welcome. Well, nice to be here.
And we want to hear from you. Perhaps you are an adjunct professor and you're listening between classes. You can join us via email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Facebook or Twitter. So you've put together this two-part series, the second part of which aired today.
Yes.
And people, listeners who are listening to this program who may have missed the series can go to our website at wfae.org and hear both parts. It covers a lot of ground, but one of the most disturbing things that I heard was that at many schools, tenured faculty are advising their adjunct colleagues not to even try going down the path of making teaching a full-time career. Did that surprise you?
Actually, it didn't, because I talked to a lot
of... And you used to do this, didn't you?
I was not an adjunct.
Okay.
I was a full-time
okay.
professor right. with benefits at Clark Atlanta University some years ago. So, no, I was not an adjunct.
Okay.
But in talking to lots of adjuncts in different parts of the country, no, I was not surprised to hear that, because a lot of them say it's very hard commuting back and forth from one campus to another, sometimes three campuses, sometimes long distances.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the average salary per class is about $2,700, according to the American Association of University Professors, a lot of them make a lot less than that. Some make maybe $1,600 per course. If you have a PhD, of course, you make more. If you're specialized, high demand area, you make more. But there are a lot who are not making those high figures. So, yeah, it's hard. So, no, I was not surprised that they are advising some to do something else as opposed to trying to be an adjunct full-time.
So is that what they're saying, don't be an adjunct full-time? Or are they saying that don't be a college professor because your chances of becoming a part of the tenured faculty are practically nil or extremely difficult?
No, I don't know if they're saying that, but they are advising them, if you love to teach and you really want to do this, try to also find something that you love as well and teach on the side as an adjunct, because it's going to be really hard to make a living at it.
One of the things that I think either came out in your series or came out in a lot of the articles that I read yesterday was that a lot of the tenured faculty are oblivious to the problems facing the part-time faculty, the adjunct faculty. When you were a tenured professor, were you aware of what these people go through?
No, I was not tenured. I was
when you were full-time.
Full-time, yes. I wasn't on the tenure track. But, yes, I had colleagues who came in and they wanted to get additional courses. The courses were not available. Or I also talked to people who, say, for instance, had a class canceled at the last minute or were assigned a class at the last minute and had very little time to prepare. Those are some of the complaints that adjuncts I talk to and, as you said, in articles talk about. Sometimes they have prepared for a course and they're last minute told, well, we didn't get the enrollment. Or as one professor, a tenured professor, said to me, sometimes it's an issue of, okay, we didn't get enough students in a tenured track professor's
right.
course, so we're going to give that course we were going to give to you to the tenured track, so you're out.
So what is driving this rise in the number of adjunct faculty being used at colleges and universities around the country? What's the reason for it?
From what I have been talking to people, one of the things is cost savings because you're not paying health benefits. The amount that you're paying at Junts is much less than you would pay a tenure track. Some of them, a lot of them, are making just under $20,000 or $20,000, $30,000 a year. That's a big difference from some
tenure. So they're making less than the average tuition. In some cases.
Yeah, that's correct. And actually, at the same time, the tuition has doubled nationwide in the last 25 years. We've also had an explosion in the use of adjuncts. And also, and sometimes the categories are a little bit there's boundaries. But there's lecturers, adjuncts, also teaching assistants, and sometimes we kind of lump those in. So maybe terms like non-tenured track is a good way to put that all together. But they are now teaching a majority of classes around the country. It's also driven by an overproduction of people with PhDs. There are too many people. I have a history PhD. For a variety of historic reasons, there are too many people out there now with history PhDs. Mm. The year before I got my job here, I was one of 162 applicants at another university, at UNCG. And I was very close to getting that job, but being number two didn't help me, you know. Eventually, I was extremely fortunate to get this position. But I've seen that, too, by serving on search committees. We'll have 100 applicants, including for one position, including people coming from University of Chicago, from Oxford, from Ivy League schools,
wow,
and so on.
We just did a program, and there's been a lot of discussion on the topic of the remarkable increase in the cost of a college education and how students are leaving with an average, I think, of 30-some plus thousand dollars in debt per person, with $1.25 trillion of cumulative debt in the country just on student loans. Is this one of the key tools that universities use to keep costs down?
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about this, it varies a lot by sector. And so if you average over the whole higher ed sector, you might say that 40% or even 50% of the teaching is being done by people who are adjuncts of some form or another. But in fact, the highest percentages are in the for-profit institutions. High percentages are in community colleges. At a place like UNC Charlotte, less than 25% of the student credit hours are taught by people who are part-time faculty. Mm. And we've tried to invest in full-time positions for people who have master's degrees, who are lecturers, or people who have PhDs, who may be senior lecturers, or who may be people who have other kinds of professorial titles, like teaching professor or clinical professor. So it's not really a kind of one-size-fits-all, but I think it is true that there are a couple of reasons why universities use people who are part-time people. One is to respond to changes in enrollment. In 2012, we had an unexpected number of freshmen, and we had to scramble to get people to meet those classes. We did it by hiring primarily people on one-year contracts.
Back up just a second on that, because students start applying for colleges in, what, their junior year in high school. So if the applications are coming in and the applications are being accepted by the admissions office, how can you be surprised by the influx of people coming in?
Because you can't always predict the yield. So you offer admission.
They may turn you down.
They may turn you down, or they may come in numbers that you didn't anticipate. So one reason for hiring people as part-timers is to meet unexpected demand. Another reason is that part-time people can bring other kinds of expertise that you don't have resident in the faculty. Mm-hmm. In a place like Charlotte, we can hire people who are working in positions in business or government who have a lot of experience, a lot of professional experience that brings a lot to the classroom. Those folks are willing to come and teach in our programs, and they bring a lot to the classroom that we may not have in our regular tenure-track faculty. And then the fact is, in some fields, we need a lot of people, and we've sustained a lot of cuts. All public institutions over the past decade have sustained a lot of cuts in funding that haven't been made up by the states. And so, yes, some of it is cost control.
I guess some of the people that come in who are in business and industry who act as adjunct professors don't have to worry about the stipend or whatever you're going to pay them, whatever you call that, the mm-hmm. salary, the fee that they're being paid to teach those classes. But Gwendolyn, the Atlantic magazine did a big article on this, and they report that 31% of part-time faculty nationwide are living near or below the federal poverty line. Did that come up in your story, and do you know what the North Carolina figure might be?
I don't know what the North Carolina figure is because I wasn't able to get that. But, yeah, that I talked to a lot who said they have used public assistance. They have had, because they don't have benefits, they don't have health insurance, and they have had to, you know, some of them have families, and their children need health care. So, yes, they have had to go on public assistance. Some have gone on public assistance for food stamps, for many things, because they're doing something they really love, and they are hoping to get that full-time position. So they are hanging in there and kind of living on the edge of poverty just with the hopes that, you know, this is going to turn into something full-time. So, yes, some of them are on food stamps.
Right. And there was another report recently that indicated that 22% of adjuncts around the country are living in poverty and an additional 32% right at the poverty line. And so and the 22% represents a substantially high percentage than living in poverty in general in this country.
Dr. Lorden, would you know what the figure is of those teachers who work for you who may be at the poverty line or below the poverty line, either at UNC Charlotte or at the university system or within North Carolina as a whole? Will you know the answer to that question?
I don't think I know that, no.
Do you think that parents and students know this about the teachers in the front of the classroom?
I don't know that parents and students know in any detail who's teaching in the classroom. I mean, they assume that we hire people who are qualified, and we do. But I think the report that was here this morning, I think, made the point that trying to make a career out of being an adjunct is really not a great idea. I mean,
if people didn't do it, would you have a lot of empty classrooms?
Well, I don't think that – I mean, we have relatively few people who are teaching multiple classes for us. I mean, we hire people who are teaching primarily one or two classes. If people are teaching more than that, if they're teaching 10 credits, then they're getting benefits. But I think the question is how do you really use people, or what do you think about if you're taking a job as an adjunct? It's generally, I think, not a stepping stone to a full-time position, although some of the people that we hire who work for us over a period of time do get hired into permanent positions when they become available as lecturers.
You're one of those people, Dr. Cox, who started as an adjunct, if I'm not mistaken, and now are a full-time tenure-track professor. Is that correct? What was your path? Tell these people out there who are yearning for that how you did it.
Yeah, sure. Well, my path was a pretty standard one. I got my PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, and despite the fact that getting a degree in modern German history and the Holocaust at Carolina really is like one of the one or two best places in the world where you could get that, where you could study the Holocaust at a PhD level. Nonetheless, there were not many jobs out there, as I was saying earlier. I managed, after a couple of years as teaching as an adjunct, to get a position at Florida Gulf Coast University, where I was not the least bit happy. But yet I have friends, for various reasons, but I had friends who ended up at places like UT Pan Am, the University of South Dakota, and these were the lucky ones who got jobs. And again, people coming from UNC, one of the top history graduate schools in the country. So there are a lot of people, most adjuncts, and there are some. In fact, I helped to incorporate some adjuncts into our history department at Florida Gulf Coast, and sometimes they were retired. We had some rabbis, we had some retired professors, but most adjuncts are people who were trying to get a tenure-track job, and there simply aren't tenure-track jobs out there.
Dr. John Cox is an associate professor of international studies and history at UNC Charlotte. He's here along with Dr. Joan Lorden, who's the provost and vice chancellor for academic affairs there, and Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg County Solid Waste. Recycling one ton of plastic bottles saves about 160 gallons of petroleum and enough electricity to power a house for about 6 months. Together we can wipe out waste, wipeoutwaste.com. And UNC's Nutrition Research Institute presenting a public lecture on the importance of our gut microbiome to our health and how microbial studies are leading toward personalized diets for optimal health today at 6 p.m. Details at uncnri.org. Well, some believe electric cars are the future, and that future is being driven by Tesla. But here in North Carolina, there are some roadblocks to Tesla's success. We talk about that and about Charlotte history tours on this program tomorrow at 9. We're hosting a series of voter roundtables on Charlotte Talks next week with listeners on the panel, and we're looking for a couple of conservative-leaning voters to join in still. So find out more and get in touch with our producers right now at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the number of health insurance companies participating in the Affordable Care Act exchanges is dwindling, and many of the insurance plans available under the law exclude more doctors and hospitals than do employer plans. The Affordable Care Act, 3 years in, what's working and what's not.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about adjunct faculty and the rise in the numbers of those professors at colleges and universities and community colleges around the country in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. With Dr. Joan Lorden from UNC Charlotte, Dr. John Cox also from that university, Gwendolyn Glenn, who's produced a series of reports. Two long-form reports on this, which were on this radio station this morning and yesterday morning, and you can hear them again on WFAE.org. I know you talked about how, Dr. Lorden, there are not as many adjunct faculty perhaps at UNC Charlotte as there are at other colleges, but in the last 10, 20, 30 years, how has the number increased there?
I think the number has gone up and down. If you track the number of student credit hours that are taught by part-time faculty over the past 10 years, it's varied from about 17 or 18% to about 23%.
Now, numbers that I did get from UNC Charlotte was that over the past 5 years that the number of adjuncts went from 405 adjuncts to 541 today. So that may give you a clearer picture of the number that are there.
Well, that's an increase of the headcount, but we've also increased the number of students. So in terms of the proportion of classes and credit hours being taught by part-time faculty, it's been fairly stable.
So when you talk about increasing the number of students, you're talking about increasing the number of classes, number of teaching hours, and therefore the number of people needed to teach. At JCSU, the figure that I have here, according to, I'm not sure where this came from, but I have a figure for JCSU as of November the 1st, 165 total faculty with 93 full-time and 72 part-time.
Yes, that's the number that I have as well, that they have 72 who are part-time.
And we'll be talking to somebody later in the program from Duke University, and they don't release their figures because they're a private school, but maybe we can get some figures out of that person now, when they join us.
JCSU, they do their they pay their adjuncts a little differently. They pay by credit hour rates, and it's something like from $150 to $250. And then you multiply that by the number of students you have in your class, and say, for instance, and two, by the degree, a PhD teaching 10 students and highly specialized, maybe you would get about $2,500 per course. So that's very low, and some of the teachers there who are adjuncts are teaching 4 and 5 classes, and then some said they know of people who are teaching 8 classes and going from campus to campus to try to piece all of this together to get a living wage. And I just wanted to ask you two, I remember when you were saying, Dr. Cox, when you were adjuncting, that to supplement your salary that you had to work as a bartender and as a waiter.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I did that after I finished my degree. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I was driving down to George Mason to teach a couple classes, which paid $2,200. Like everywhere, I was then paying a lot of money to park down there. And so, yeah, I'd made more money bartending and things like that. But like most adjuncts, I was trying to get experience. And I was trying to not just get experience, but I wanted to get a full-time tenure-track job. Again, I was one of the fortunate ones who was able to do so.
This sounds not unlike the fast food argument, the fast food minimum wage argument that we've been hearing a lot about, in that these jobs were not ever meant to be full-time jobs for adults supporting families. What I think I heard you say, Dr. Lorden, is that that's the case with adjuncts. You really shouldn't depend on this as a full-time position because it's not.
Well, you know, when I got out of graduate school, I also actually did a term as an adjunct professor. But in graduate school, I had been supported on fellowships, so I didn't actually have very much in the way of teaching experience. So when I was a postdoc, I took a job as an adjunct teaching a course at a small private institution to get experience, and it was very useful. And I think that's great. Or if you're a retired faculty member or someone who's come out of business or is somebody who simply enjoys teaching and wants to do it, there are reasons for taking these positions. But I think the people we need to worry about are these folks who are trying to make a living going from campus to campus, piecing together a career. And I think, you know, as institutions, we need to think about paying them fairly. So we've set a minimum of $3,000 per course. That's a minimum. 50% of our part-time faculty make more than that. People with master's degrees make more than that. People with PhDs, the minimum is $3,500. Half of them make more than that.
And how many classes can they potentially teach in a semester?
They don't generally teach. Some people who will teach labs teach multiple classes. But for the most part, we have people who are teaching two classes at most. I mean, because if you're working at a regular job, you don't have the time to.
So that's $12,000 a year if you teach two classes for two semesters. That's $12,000 with no benefits.
Which if you teach 10 credit hours for 3 months or more, you do get health, you are offered health benefits. Mm-hmm. I think what we saw was we had about 59 people who met that criterion, but only three actually took.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, too, I mean, one thing, because it's been suggested here that people almost choose the path of being full-time adjuncts. But again, our adjuncts have master's degrees. Many of them have PhDs. And what happens, too, though, is they get stuck in a cycle because they're working for such low wages. They're part of the working poor population of this country that they're not able to build up their resume or their CV so that they can take advantage of a job opening that appears. I've seen this happen on UNC Charlotte, and I've seen it in many other campuses. That is, that someone who's devoted 6 or 7 or 8 years teaching 3 or 4 classes a semester oftentimes then is not as qualified to compete for a job, even if they have a PhD, because they haven't been participating in conferences, making publications, and so on.
Outsourcing jobs to part-timers has been going on in industries around America for a long time, but they're usually outsourcing side jobs, not the core business jobs. Those jobs generally go to full-time employees. The core business, it seems to me, of a college or a university is teaching. So why are you outsourcing the core jobs to part-time people?
So as I've said, I think there are some reasons why we always want to have some part-time people. We want to be able to bring in people who have special expertise where we may not have the demand for example, in some language courses. One of the departments that uses the most part-time people is our Department of Language and Culture Studies. We are able to offer a wide range of language courses to students at least a beginning level because we have people in this community that we can hire to teach courses like Farsi. We don't have a large demand for that, but we can offer it to students. So that's, I think, a positive reason for hiring part-time people.
Well, you may
people.
Be the exception to the rule, but there are some colleges, correct me if I'm wrong, Gwendolyn, that are, and universities, that more than 50% of their faculty
That's
is
true.
Part-time.
That's true. I did see numbers like that where it's that high at some it's 40%, which is still high, 30-something percent. And I think that one thing that some adjuncts told me that they look at is they're seeing how little they're being paid. They're doing sometimes the same work as the full-time tenure track people, but they're not getting anywhere near the salary. And then they're looking, too, at the savings the university is making by not paying them the large salaries or giving them the benefits. And then they're seeing buildings go up, and that is one shift that is going away from salaries for professors, as you said, the core, to things like higher salaries for administration and buildings.
Let's talk about that. When you have administrators making several hundred thousand dollars a year and you have coaches making millions of dollars a year and you have these big student union buildings going up with all the latest technology and recreational facilities for students and you have stadiums being built, how can you then justify? How do you justify 30 to 50% of the faculty being part-time and being paid such low wages? I'm not pointing fingers at UNC Charlotte. You're just at the table. how the universities and colleges justify it to parents who are paying a lot of money for their kids to go to school.
Well, we have a lot of expenses in addition to the teaching faculty. I mean, the teaching faculty make up the largest part of my budget. But, you know, we need facilities. We're growing. We provide access. We have to build buildings if we're going to teach the students.
Last year from the Institute of Policy Studies found that at the 25 state schools with the highest paid presidents, the number of part-time adjunct faculty increased 22% faster between 2005 and 2011 than the average national growth for all universities. That means, it seems to me, that they're offsetting bloat with part-time faculty.
Well, I think in that same report also indicated that the number or the percentage of administrators has grown in the last quarter century has grown at 10 times the rate of the number of tenure line faculties. So there's no doubt that there has been an explosion of highly paid administrators at the same time that we're getting away. And I should say, too, that really almost all of my friends who are adjuncts who've been doing it for years and who sometimes teach four classes a semester who drive to two or three campuses, they would be satisfied. It would be a big step up to receive like a $45,000 a year lectureship. That would give some security. Again, these are people with masters and PhDs. And even a $45,000 lectureship, which sounds modest compared to, again, what we're paying many administrators, would be like, you know, would be a wonderful thing for most of our adjuncts.
Let's put this into some perspective for people who are not teachers and have never been in a classroom as a teacher. If you're teaching a college class, a single class, that class usually meets an hour three times a week or, 90 minutes twice a week. Is that correct? So people just think, well, $3,000 to teach for 3 hours a week, that sounds like a deal to me. But there's a lot more to it.
That's
than
how they
that.
Think in Raleigh. What you just said seems to be what our politicians think up in
so
Raleigh.
There's a lot more to it. Obviously, you have to prepare the lecture. You have to grade the papers and the test. You have to prepare the tests.
Right.
What other things are required of adjunct faculty?
I think there's an expectation that people will spend some time meeting with students that have questions. So, yeah, I think adjunct faculty do an important job for universities, and I mean, I certainly wouldn't argue that they should not be paid fairly. And I think
seriously, I have a friend who's an adjunct professor, and I've heard – I wouldn't do it. I would refuse to do some of the things he's being asked to do on his own time, like take professional development for no reason because it's not going to lead to any advancement. To take tests on various requirements that the school has that teachers know, which takes 3 and 4 hours to study for the test, and then you have to take the test. It just doesn't make any sense. Why would anybody put themselves through that?
Some people enjoy it. I mean, we really have people who enjoy teaching. We get more people coming to us wanting to teach than you might imagine.
Because
that's one thing that some say they feel like they are being taken advantage of because they do love what they do and they're doing it. And as you say, advising students, and many of them don't have offices to meet with those students. So they are having to come back to campus when they are not teaching class. So that's another thing, coming back to campus to meet with students. And I've read stories of some saying they are meeting with them in their cars and in coffee shops and places because they don't have places to work.
And actually, yeah, if I may, I'm going to read a short thing. And this is from someone who's teaching at a college in Massachusetts. But when you asked earlier about our tenure track, I think people are really oblivious. You don't know the trials and tribulations of their teachers or the students. They don't realize that half their students might be people who are struggling and who might be going to the plasma center after work. Anyway, I'm going to read this short thing. This, again, is at another college. I teach English 3 or 4 courses in spring and fall, 2 during the summer. These are grading intensive courses. I spend much of my time marking papers, doing classwork. Last year, I barely cleared $20,000. I spend 10 to 12 hours just commuting, et cetera. I have $40,000 in student loans. I don't think I'll ever be able to repay that. I hate summers because it means less money. In what profession does one work for 2 whole months before a paycheck? This is saying that in the fall we start working in August and don't get paid until mid-October. This is also a problem, frankly, at UNC Charlotte. This was the last straw for a couple of my friends last summer who taught in the summer session and didn't get paid until the session ended. Anyway, this person concludes, unfortunately, I love my work and my students, and I feel like my life has some meaning, but I don't know how, which is why I'm still doing this, but I don't know how much longer I can suffer through this. I'm always one unexpected bill away from total financial crisis. Meanwhile, administrative positions have exploded something like 250%, and administrative salaries have skyrocketed. Administrators often have far less education than faculty, and so on. Meanwhile, the faculty, the backbone of higher ed, try to keep from starving. This is obscene. This is a quote from, someone teasing in Massachusetts that was in an article in The Atlantic recently.
Has the administration within the university system in North Carolina exploded in numbers over the teaching faculty in recent years?
I think when we talk about administration in universities, a lot of times people make the divide between faculty and people who are non-faculty. And I think one of the things that you see is that we have a lot of people who we hire who are professional advisors. We have people that we hire in financial aid. We have people that we hire to do Title IX compliance. Mm-hmm. The cost of compliance at universities has gone up very dramatically. When I came to UNC Charlotte, we had two attorneys. We now have a much larger number because we have a much larger compliance program. Issues around safety and security, all of these things have driven up the costs of higher education. And if you look at public universities over the past decade, I mean, most public universities have on average lost over 25% of their state funding. I mean, if you look at the institutions in this country that represent the largest portion of higher education, 50% of higher education, they've lost in the billions of dollars from state funding. So there's been a dramatic loss, and that money's not coming back. Plus, there have been increases in compliance costs. So universities, public universities, are in a tight spot.
A lot of people have been responding to this topic today on Facebook, Twitter, and email. Let me share a couple of comments. Karen on Facebook, I feel squeamish about paying top dollar for college to be taught by a grad student or a part-time professor while some tenured professor gets paid the big bucks to write books and articles. Is that an accurate picture?
No. I mean, our tenure faculty, being on the tenure track is not an easy job. And part of a university's mission is to increase knowledge. It's discovery. And so our tenured faculty develop curriculum. Our tenured faculty write books. They get grants. And getting grants to support scientific research is no easy matter.
Kathy writes, I'm listening to this topic with great interest. I'm an EDD. What is that?
Doctor of Education.
Okay, Doctor of Education candidate. And my dissertation topic is the effect of part-time faculty on community college retention. What I'm hearing from your guests is both relevant and aligns with my research. That leads to a question about quality of education, and we're going to ask that question and more when we come back from the break, because some people allege that kids aren't getting what their parents or they themselves aren't paying for when we have adjunct faculty leading the way in many of these locations. And we're going to hear from someone from Duke University. They're a special case because Duke has joined the ranks of about 40 other colleges and universities around the country, where the adjunct faculty has risen up and said, enough is enough, and we want some representation. And evidently it's taking hold at Duke University. We'll do that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Central Piedmont Community College's Ballantyne Center, offering continuing education courses to help professionals earn high-demand job credentials. Details at cpcc.edu/Ballantyne. And Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing comprehensive services and customized treatment plans. More at novanthealth.org/orthopedics. The number of health insurance companies participating in the Affordable Care Act exchanges is dwindling, and many of the insurance plans available under the law exclude more doctors and hospitals than do employer plans. So on the Diane Rehm Show, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they'll be talking about the Affordable Care Act 3 years in, what's working, and what is not. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your shot. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Brazil is the largest economy in Latin America. This could have huge repercussions in the region.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
There was a moment that took Dan Bishop's breath away. It came as he watched U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announce the federal government was suing North Carolina over House Bill 2.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about adjunct faculty at colleges and universities across the country with Dr. Joan Lorden, Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at UNC Charlotte. Dr. John Cox is an Associate Professor of International Studies and History there, and he's also on the I'm trying to find my notes here. You're on the part-time faculty committee, which we'll talk about in a couple of seconds. Gwendolyn Glenn is with us from WFAE News. Her two-part series on all of this can be heard at WFAE.org. The final installment aired this morning on the radio. One of the places where adjunct faculty have begun to organize for change is at Duke University. And joining us now for the remainder of the program is MJ Sharp, an instructor with the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. She's a full-time, non-tenured faculty member working on a year-to-year contract and a professional photographer and documentarian. Welcome to the program, MJ.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you.
You're on a year-to-year contract at Duke University. Does that make
you
full-time faculty at Duke, or are you still considered an adjunct?
Well, I'm a full-time non-tenure track faculty member, and what we've discovered as we have all been getting to know each other at Duke through the union is that there are lots and lots of different designations for people. There are people working, you know, semester to semester all the way up to, you know, three-year contracts, five-year contracts. So non-tenure track faculty can there's a lot of different people that fall under that umbrella. So my particular situation is I started teaching semester to semester, and then converted to a year to year, which got me benefits. So that was my particular story over the past 3 or 4 years.
And does Duke University use what we've been talking about this morning, adjunct faculty who come in and teach maybe one or two courses a semester for a pay-per-course kind of fee structure arrangement?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've been listening to the program, and it's just been – you all have covered everything so spectacularly well. I was telling your producer that for someone for whom this is all new, unsettling information, and for a lot of people, you know, they have no idea that this is what goes on in academia now. I think you all have given them a wonderful primer of how it all works. At Duke, there are, you know, I think 40% is non-tenure track faculty, and it varies from, you know, semester to semester, like I said, to, you know, multi-year contracts that are all still not tenure track. But I think something that I think was alluded to earlier by someone that I think is really important is that the thing that's not maybe worth pausing and considering a little bit is the student experience when adjunct faculty has more stability, because when I go from, you know, a semester to a semester to even a year to year, suddenly, you know, all of my professional development that I do on my own dime, you know, just because I'm a professional in my field and I love it, I'm going to keep up with it and I'm going to contribute to it, but that's all self-funded. There's no research fund for me, right? But the more stability you have, the more it's worth it to really invest in the institution, which helps your students a lot, because then you begin to have institutional knowledge about, oh, there's this grant for you to pursue this interest of yours, or, you know, and the more you keep up in your field, the better equipped you are to teach as well. So it's a labor of love that people, that I think the main take-home, I think, is that contingent faculty provide an excellent academic experience in the classroom, but they provide it sort of from their own flesh, not so yeah. much because it's institutionally supported.
Well, Adrian Kazaran, I think you talk about this person or the Delphi Project, Gwendolyn, in your stories, says that students are not getting what they pay for, or if they are, it is because these adjunct professors themselves are subsidizing these students' education.
Yes, and that was something that particular, and it's called the Delphi Project, and they've looked at this very closely. And one thing they found out was that students who have lots of adjuncts, they have a tendency to drop out. They have a higher dropout rate.
Do they know why?
And, well, one thing they said that what I read was that in terms of the advising, some students say the adjunct is not there, and they don't realize that they're being taught by an adjunct oftentimes. They just know they can't find their professor when they need help after class. And they say that could be a contributing factor. And also some of the adjuncts, because they are not in meetings, some of them are not allowed on some campuses. I don't know if that's at UNC Charlotte, but I know on some campuses they are not allowed to attend meetings. So they don't know the most updated information in terms of advising them about taking courses. And they are not there when the students need them. So they say all of those things are contributing factors that could be affecting that dropout rate. And
yeah, I think a couple other factors, too. I read a recent report on that. And according to this report, quote, what makes the situation even worse is that adjuncts are often disproportionately assigned to courses filled with students who need the most assistance, such as introductory courses, et cetera. And this report also makes the point that oftentimes adjuncts are in a precarious position. They sometimes are afraid to speak. It's very difficult to organize, for example, because of fear, even more greater job insecurity. Well, but that can also lead to excessive concern about your student evaluations, and so not challenging students as much. But I think the main factor is simply that you're working too much. You might be teaching on three campuses.
Duke University is a private institution, and you've been able to organize, MJ, and we'll talk about that. But I think at the University of North Carolina system and other state schools, they are not allowed to organize because this is a right-to-work state, and the state government doesn't allow that. Is that true?
That's right, yep. Which, honestly, was part of, I think part of at least my motivation. I mean, I can't speak for everyone at Duke, but I think part of the motivation for many of us on the organizing committee was that we could do it. You know, we could do it. And the fact is that, you know, teaching conditions at Duke are, you know, we love our students and we're not, you know, overloaded with students in ways that can happen sometimes at other universities, at least in my experience. I mean, I've sort of taught at a few different places. And so in a certain way, to me, it felt as though we had an obligation to really step up because we could, because, you know, we could devote time to organizing and to coming together. And, you know, we're not all panting to just keep up.
And you point to the size of the vote, MJ. You point to the size of the vote.
Yeah.
This is a right-to-work state, so you
right.
don't have to belong to a union to enjoy the benefits of a union if you unionize or organize. But the vote was 174 in favor to 29 against. And you say that's indicative of the problem.
Well, yes, because, you know, what we dealt with a lot was that, you know, we dealt with a lot of, you know, the administration, I think, was thinking, you know, let's solve this just one-to-one. You know, let's just, if you've got a problem, talk to your supervisor, talk, you know, just keep going up the chain of command until you get, you know, your needs met. And I think they probably really believed that that was able to happen or that that had happened. And I think our experience, you know, boots on the ground, was that that is a great theory, but it doesn't actually work with someone that's right above you, that's hiring you, that then their hands are tied in terms of their budget. So pretty much it just, there's no way to get there from here.
Duke University, MJ, when you were considering organizing, sent out a letter to the faculty encouraging them not to be involved
right.
in this, and that kind of fell on deaf ears. What has been their reaction now that you have organized?
Well, I think that, you know, I think they've been cordial about it. You know, I think that we're all looking forward to, you know, a now legally mandated sitting down together to try to, you know, solve these issues together in good faith. And, you know, we haven't had any indications that that's not going to go well. You know, I'm looking forward to it. To me, being an academic person now, it feels as though this is a problem, you know, this, as you all have so rightly discussed, is all over academia. And the problem is that it's such a difficult, thorny thing to try to solve because, I mean, it looks to me as though it grew out of this honorarium system of, like, bringing in someone with special skills and paying them, like, an honorarium because they had health insurance. They had a full-time income somewhere else. And what's happened is that that's now become a model for a permanent underclass of close to half of university faculty.
Yeah, but you've called this a terrible, terrible thing. Gwendolyn, go ahead.
Well, one thing I was going to add, you asked about the intimidation factor. One thing that I've found that a lot of campuses are bringing in these high-powered law firms to keep the unions from forming, and that's intimidating to some adjuncts who said that they have that fear of maybe they'll lose their jobs. And I think what has spurred a lot of this was they had a national walkout day this year and last year for adjuncts, a national walkout day. And a lot of them said once they saw others participating, it gave them kind of encouragement that, okay, I think we need to do this as well and not be intimidated by these high-powered law firms right. that are coming on campus.
So I think, you know, another question here is, okay, I think there's plenty of evidence that there are people who are not being well treated, they're not being well paid, they're not being given benefits. I think the question is, what should universities be doing?
And
I think there are some things that universities are doing. I think we have department chairs who really do value and take care of their part-time faculty. But I think if you look at the question of what universities are doing, there are a number of things. One is, are we asking the question of whether or not we've produced too many PhDs in some areas? And I think graduate schools have, over the past 10 or 15 years, really looked at that carefully. I think some institutions have been very good about making sure that applicants to PhD programs know not just what the admissions rate is, but how well the students are going to be funded. What the attrition rate is, what the placement rate is, and where students get placed. And those are things that I think every student should look at before going into a PhD program. There have been other kinds of programs that have been offered for people who want to go into graduate education but don't necessarily want to pursue a full-time career in teaching, so professional science master's degrees. And then I think there's been the creation of non-tenure track but multi-year contract employees. So people who want to teach, there are people who don't want to do a full tenure track type job, are going into positions in which they have multi-year contracts and which they are teaching professors or clinical professors.
Charles writes, one of our listeners, I was an adjunct at UNC Chapel Hill for 3 years on campus and 2 4 semesters conducting an online class. While UNC paid somewhat more than most schools, I did have an office, a rarity among adjuncts. I found it extremely difficult to be effective as a teacher. I had to continue working as a freelancer just to pay the bills and stay current in my field. There were no benefits, little time to prepare in some cases, and while I was fortunate to have a chance to apply for full-time, I ran afoul of the politics of the department and was denied the position. I left shortly afterward in recognition of the fact that there was no way forward, which I hear a lot about. There's right. no way forward for adjuncts. From what
and
I can see, this
up,
is... Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That's come up actually a lot in with the Duke faculty talking amongst ourselves as well, because, you know, it is true, and in my case, absolutely, that your department head is very sympathetic. But if their hands are tied by budgetary decisions above them, they're in effect, you know, 100 little glass ceilings all over the university, and your individual department head is put in the unhappy position of having to say, oh, I can't take care of you the way I'd like to because decisions are being made above me that are causing that. And I think that part of what we were after at Duke was, let's enter into a legally mandated process where we raise the floor. You know, so if we're not doing any. The ceiling can go as high as we want, as high as any individual wants, but we got to raise the floor so that the default is not what it is now.
Christopher writes, it was my experience at CPCC and other community colleges that many institutions publish large, perhaps unrealistic course offerings or only to cancel many classes at the last minute for lack of enrollment. It's a disservice to the student who might think they can complete a program when in fact they cannot. It's a disservice to the adjunct whose employment is rescinded at a late date. It only benefits the college and the administrators who show a much bigger program than exists in reality. And perhaps that's the root of the issue, increasing the number of administrative and management jobs on campus at the expense of classroom teaching. And then there's the question of the hours that these people put in on their own time for students, for themselves, for the necessary preparation work, etc. And some have described this, some adjuncts have described this as wage theft.
Right. And it should be known, too, that, again, that despite all these obstacles that our adjuncts face, many of them are among our very finest teachers. I have a good friend who teaches at UNCG. He's often put up by his department for teaching excellence awards. He's won some of these. Yet then when an assistant professorship came up, again, he hadn't been able to build up his CV, and he did not get a job that he really deserved.
The move toward using contingency workers is not unique to colleges and universities. It's happening in industries all over the country. And in June of last year, California labor regulators ruled that an Uber driver was not an independent contractor, but in fact an employee of Uber and deserved back pay. And since then, lawsuits have been filed on behalf of similar workers at other companies and in other industries. Do you worry about this happening at the university level?
Certainly could happen. I think, you know, in the UNC system in the time I've been here, there has really been a lot of attention given to the question of whether or not we can control the amount of part-time employment. And in fact, there's been periodically a real push to try to increase the number of people in full-time positions.
And you get the last word. We're not going to solve this problem in 58 minutes here, but Dr. Joan Lorden is the provost and vice chancellor for academic affairs at UNC Charlotte, where Dr. John Cox is associate professor of international studies and history. MJ Sharp joined us from Duke University's an instructor of documentary studies there, and Gwendolyn Glenn, whose reports can be heard on WFAE.org.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Cox.